debt and abuse of the Earth's resources, a death economy. Less than 5% of the world's population, I said, lives in the U.S., and we consume more than 25% of the resources, while half the world suffers from desperate poverty. That's not a model. It can't be replicated, not by China, India, Brazil, Turkey, or any other country, no matter how hard they try. Yes, he said. Fear, debt, and another very important strategy, divide and conquer. He talked about the schism between Sunnis and Shiites, and about how civil wars and tribal factions create power vacuums that open the doors to exploitation. In such disputes, he continued, both parties take on more debt, buy more arms, destroy resources and infrastructure, and then accept even more debt to finance reconstruction. We're seeing it throughout the Middle East, in Syria, Iraq, Egypt, Afghanistan. So many countries are the building blocks for billionaires. I asked what he thought it would take to transform the death economy into a life economy. You have to go after the businessmen, the CEOs and major stockholders of the multinationals that run the world. They are the roots of the problem. The next day, flying home from Istanbul, looking down on the Mediterranean, I found that, in addition to guilt, I felt a growing sense of anger. Our business and government leaders were taking the EHM system way beyond anything imaginable in my time, or in the era of the feudal emperors who, during the so-called Dark Ages, ruled the lands beneath my plane. I couldn't help suspecting that future historians would look back on the post-9/11 era as an even darker age. My anger mounted at the realization that we in the United States are told that we must fear scarcity, that we should buy more, work harder, keep accumulating, bury ourselves in more and more debt. This mentality goes beyond the personal to become an aspect of national patriotism. Our country must amass increasing amounts of the world's resources. We are assured that the debt used to finance the military is necessary for our own good, the same argument that had been used on the subjects of those feudal emperors. It was particularly infuriating to recall that when we point out that military spending reduces our benefits, we are told that social programs encourage indolence, whereas programs that support armies, subsidize windfall profits, and encourage corporate barons to speculate with our tax dollars fuel the engines of economic growth. That top-down economics works, despite the overwhelming evidence of the past decade to the contrary. As I looked down at the English Channel, once the dividing line between archenemies Protestant England and Catholic France, I was struck by how much stronger this system has become since my EHM days, and how, after 9/11, the EHM system came home to roost. The use of debt and fear, the Patriot Act, the militarization of police forces, a vast array of new surveillance technologies, the infiltration and sabotage of the Occupy movement, and the dramatic expansion of privatized prisons have strengthened the U.S. government's ability to marginalize those who oppose it. Giant corporate-funded political action committees, PACs, reinforced by Citizens United and other court decisions, and billionaires like the Koch brothers, who finance groups such as the American Legislative Action Council, ALEC, subvert the democratic process and win elections by flooding the media with propaganda. They hire cadres of lawyers, lobbyists, and strategists to legalize corruption and to influence every level of government. When I arrived back in the United States, I discovered something that reinforced my anger. Although Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, had survived the coup attempt and had announced that Ecuador would auction off oil rights in its Amazon region, he was once again under attack by one of those divide-and-conquer campaigns. He was being strangled by those roots of the problem that Ulich had described, the people who control the big corporations. Chapter 41. A Coup Against Fundación Pachamama. Although the attempted coup against Correa had failed, on another level, it had succeeded. I figured the jackals had learned from that other failed coup in Seychelles that sometimes it is better to let a president survive. Sufficiently scared, he or she then plays the game, joins the ranks of all those other heads of state who know that to resist is futile. In any case, Correa had reversed his previous position and had posted for sale to oil companies signs on more than 6 million acres in 13 areas of the Amazon, known as blocks. Yet, something had gone wrong. The opposition to the oil auction had weakened Correa's resolve, or at least forced him to change his plans. He had vacillated. He had postponed the auction twice since November 2012. By the time I returned from Vietnam and Istanbul, the oil companies and their public relations people had swung into action. The articles I read online, in the Spanish newspapers and blogs, shook me to the core. They were reminiscent of articles that had appeared during the Roldós presidency. They were aimed at convincing the Ecuadorian people who lived in the heavily populated Andean and coastal regions that the only way their country could finance better schools and hospitals and build the infrastructure needed to develop energy, transportation, water, and sewer systems, the only way it could raise itself from poverty, was through exploitation of its Amazonian oil. The argument was made over and over that although Ecuador was one of the poorest and most densely populated countries in the hemisphere, roughly a third of the country was sparsely populated. That third happened to be a rainforest rich with oil. I traveled the Speculator Road from Quito to Shell, and from there, by small plane and canoe, deep into Ashuar territory in the summer of 2013. I found that the Ashuar and their neighbors, the Warani, Quichua, Sapara, Shiwiar, and Shuar, were frightened, incensed, and most of all, determined to protect their lands. They understood the immense value of the rainforest, not just to them, but also to life on this planet. They referred to the forest as both the heart and the lungs of the earth. They pointed out that, in addition to being worth protecting for its own sake, the forest is one of the most biodiverse places on earth, a defense against carbon dioxide poisoning of the atmosphere, and a place where as yet unidentified plant species offer potential cures for cancer and other diseases. Bill Twist and the staffs of the Pachamama Alliance and Fundación Pachamama were spending lots of time, energy, and money supporting the indigenous people of the region. They let those people know that many of us who are the biggest consumers of oil were on their side, that we were trying to convince Americans and Europeans to consume less and to pressure oil companies to stay out of the Amazon basin. For me, it was another opportunity to redeem the sins of my past. I'd heard the false stories in the late 1960s about how Texaco would benefit the country. I'd been one of the EHMs who had encouraged the military dictators of the 1970s to swamp their countries with debt. I'd tried to woo Jaime Roldós into our ranks. I'd felt the horrible pangs of guilt. Now, I'd committed to action. One of those actions was to increase my involvement with the Pachamama Alliance. I joined Bill, Lynn, and some of our key supporters in developing a plan to help Correa. We understood that he was in a difficult position. We hoped to organize a summit that would be hosted by the president and that would show him to be a reasonable man who wanted to find alternatives to the oil auction. During this same period, the indigenous people launched their own campaigns. Supported by Fundación Pachamama, they marched from their rainforests over the Andes to the capital, picketed the presidential palace, and demanded that Correa cancel the oil auction. The protests were reported by media around the world. None of the efforts deterred Correa. He went ahead with the auction in November 2013. However, something miraculous happened. Most oil companies stayed away. Not a single U.S.-based one showed up. Bids were placed on only 4 of the 13 blocks. As an oil company executive admitted to me, it just isn't worth the risk of all the bad publicity. Ecuadorians living in the heavily populated coast and in the Andes, those who had come to believe that oil was the catalyst for economic growth, were disappointed and outraged. So were the EHMs and the CIA. Corporate moguls everywhere took notice. What happened in Ecuador was just one more sign that consciousness was changing, and that when poor people who had been marginalized in the past united, they had power. Correa was in a bind. His presidency and perhaps his life hung in the balance. In December 2013, needing a scapegoat, he sent his police to the offices of Fundación Pachamama. Dressed in street clothes, looking like ordinary citizens, 15 officers suddenly appeared at the door, flashed their badges at Executive Director Belén Páez, ordered the dissolution of the organization, and drove everyone out. They locked the doors and sealed them with stickers that accused the organization of destabilizing the government. Then the police demanded that Fundación Pachamama donate its computers, its desks, all its assets, to other organizations. Although the government never arrested any of our staff, on several occasions they followed and harassed Belén and other individuals. I traveled to Ecuador after the closing of our offices. I met with Fundación Pachamama's supporters and with representatives from other non-profit and non-governmental organizations. Needless to say, we were all extremely upset with Correa. Organizations and individuals that had previously supported him now publicly condemned his actions. Although I agreed with them, something else gnawed at me. I kept thinking about the man, Rafael Correa. Who had gotten through to him? What was he facing? I knew there was more to the story than the one we were hearing and telling ourselves. Late one afternoon, I sat alone in the place where I'd been the dinner guest of the Texaco seismologist during my first week in this country, 4 decades earlier. The restaurant at the top of the Hotel Quito, formerly the Intercontinental. Now, once again, I was treated to a spectacular view of Pichincha, hovering over the city. As the sun cast a shadow that crept down the face of the volcano, I thought about the hope that oil had seemed to offer this country in 1968. I thought about Correa's world. Much as I hated his change of heart and his actions against Fundación Pachamama, I understood. He knew he could not beat big oil, that he had to compromise, keep his job, and fight battles he had a chance of winning. Otherwise, he would be overthrown, like Honduran President Zelaya and so many others before him, or assassinated, like the president whose memory he so often invoked, Jaime Roldós. Correa was smart enough to realize that if he was taken out, he'd be replaced by a CIA puppet. In fact, Correa had accomplished a great deal. He'd been in office for nearly 8 years, a milestone for a country that had experienced 8 presidents in the decade before him. He'd invested a lot of money in public programs. He'd created Buen Vivir, a government agency charged with ascertaining that everything done by every branch of government contributed to making a good life for all Ecuadorians. He'd exhibited amazing courage when he defied Washington by closing the largest U.S. military base in Latin America and renegotiated oil contracts to the detriment of the oil companies and for the benefit of his people. His example set new standards. During his administration, the 30,000 Ecuadorian plaintiffs won their lawsuit against Chevron, now the owner of Texaco. The company was found guilty in an Ecuadorian court and was fined $9.5 billion, although Chevron continues to employ an army of lawyers to fight this decision. A new constitution was approved, the first in the world to protect the inalienable rights of nature. According to World Bank data, the poverty rate declined from 32.8% in 2010 to 22.5% in 2014. One of the things that most impressed me was the way this PhD economist stood up to the Western magnates of debt. He appointed a debt audit commission to review the legitimacy of the loans taken on by previous heads of state, especially by the CIA-supported dictators who were in power during my early EHM days. The commission uncovered many instances of illegality and illegitimacy in the country's foreign obligations. Correa refused to make a $30.6 million interest payment, choosing instead to send his country into default and to incur the wrath of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and Wall Street. As it turned out, the illegality and illegitimacy of banking operations was by no means limited to Ecuador. In fact, the United States itself, and just about every country on the planet, had once again been the victims of the criminal activities of some of the world's most respected financial institutions. Chapter 42. Another EHM Banking Scandal. The financial world was shaken by another major scandal in 2014. It included a couple of the banks that had been involved in the earlier LIBOR scandal, and some new ones. Barclays, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and the Royal Bank of Scotland pleaded guilty to rigging the price of foreign currencies and were fined more than $2.5 billion. Within a year, these four banks, plus one other, UBS, would be fined an additional $1.6 billion, along with another $1.3 billion in the case of Barclays, to settle related claims. Since 2007, the banks had operated what some of their members referred to as the cartel. Among the emails and chat room conversations of individuals involved were found their own names for their group, the Bandits Club and the Mafia. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch described the bank's foreign currency scheme as a brazen display of collusion and foreign exchange rate market manipulation. She went on to call it a breathtaking conspiracy. The words collusion and conspiracy, spoken by the U.S. Attorney General, are especially telling, given that they were used in reference to the secret collaboration of banks that for years had been considered some of the most trusted businesses in the world. The actions of the banks demonstrate that everything, conspiracy, collusion, fraud, unfair competitive practices, is justified by the corporatocracy, so long as it earns large profits. Articles about this scandal reignited my feelings of guilt. I couldn't erase the suspicion that by doing what I had done four decades earlier, I had helped open the floodgates for these tidal waves of seemingly endless corruption. Reading on, however, my feelings once again changed. Guilt turned to anger. Although I had to admit that things I'd done had set the stage, I was struck by the contrasts between the ways we EHMs had operated and the ruthlessness of the modern bankers. In my day, we worked hard to justify debts. We crafted fancy econometric models to demonstrate that our projects would generate economic growth in the targeted countries. In addition to convincing the citizens of those countries, we also needed to convince ourselves. These modern EHMs did not find it necessary to justify their actions. They were blatant. They were defiant. They were utterly ruthless. They relished their roles as bandits and mafiosi, bragging about being part of a cartel. It shocked and infuriated me to see that this new breed took pride in exploiting everyone else. Then slowly, I realized that my anger was not limited to the bankers. It included the regulators. This conspiracy had operated with impunity for at least 5 years. Who was watching? The lack of oversight was testament to the see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil attitude that is pervasive among government agencies. It is another aspect of the EHM system. Those in charge believe they are entitled to do whatever it takes to help the banks and other corporations realize the goal of maximizing profits, regardless of the social or environmental consequences. The magnitude of the punishments also said a great deal about the cozy corporate-government relationships. Although the total fines in the combined LIBOR and rigged foreign currency prices conspiracies, more than $14 billion, seemed at first like a large sum, on further inspection, I saw that they were minuscule in relation to the assets of the banks. Worse still was the knowledge that not a single officer at any of the banks had been indicted for criminal activities. Not one. I was struck by how anesthetized the American public has become to being exploited. Our willingness to wear blinders is similar to attitudes in the countries I exploited during the 1970s. In addition to the relatively secret schemes of the bankers, we are exploited by overt measures that we quietly accept as standard practice. These include the skyrocketing student debt caused by state and federal cuts in public education, the constantly increasing medical debt resulting from deficient national health care and insurance policies, predatory payday loans, tax laws that subsidize a few of the richest at the expense of the many, and the outsourcing of jobs to other countries. The mantra, "We will do whatever it takes," echoes from bank boardrooms into the halls of Congress. This was brought home during the 2015 FIFA soccer scandal. The EHM system is so pervasive that it infects all areas of society, even sports. According to charges brought by the U.S. Justice Department against leaders of international soccer's governing body, the perpetrators employed many of the tools that had been part of my EHM kit, including bribes, fraud, and money laundering, and it was done in collaboration with the big banks. The corruption was unchecked for nearly two decades and cost the communities and taxpayers of many nations fortunes while making a small number of elites wealthy. At first, I was relieved that the Justice Department had taken action. This seemed a step in the right direction. The regulators were finally regulating. Then I saw a different aspect. The soccer scandal was a smoke and mirrors diversion. Media attention focused on a non-essential aspect of life, sports, at a time when the real criminals were stealing the global economy. Individual FIFA officials were carted off in handcuffs, while bank executives awarded themselves multi-million dollar bonuses. Why were individual bank officers, whose admitted crimes affected all of us, not indicted? The obvious answer is that the bankers are members of the corporatocracy, whereas FIFA officials are not. The story that the Justice Department had uncovered so much wrongdoing among the FIFA people and was aggressively pursuing indictments diverted attention from the bigger story. The banking lobby unduly influences the Justice Department. Banks are so wealthy and powerful that they can buy our elected officials, the regulators who serve us, and the media that is supposed to keep us informed. I found myself once again thinking a lot about Howard Zinn. He and I had discussed the growing power of lobbyists. "We vote," he said. "But those we elect don't seem to listen to us anymore. They obey the commands of the people who finance their campaigns, corporate lobbyists." He pointed out that I'd done something similar. "You obeyed the World Bank." He paused. "Did you really think the World Bank wanted to end world poverty?" I saw an image of myself in 1967, while I was still in business school, standing at the entrance to the World Bank and reading the motto, "Working for a world free of poverty." I believed those seven words. But not for long. Within a few years, I discovered that the motto was symbolic of the deceptions that characterize the bank's work. Since the publication of the original version of this book, I've participated on panels and in debates where development professionals try to defend the World Bank. They argue that the work I did, and that the bank has done since, has gone a long way toward ending poverty. The facts, however, tell a different story. A recent Oxfam report revealed that almost half of the world's wealth is now owned by just 1% of the population, and that 7 out of 10 people live in countries where economic inequality has increased in the past 30 years. Slum dwellers in countries where I promoted World Bank projects, such as Argentina, Colombia, Egypt, and Indonesia, might now have mobile phones, but they are by no means free of poverty. In fact, from a comparative standpoint, they are worse off than when I was in EHM. According to World Bank statistics, 2.2 billion people still lived at a poverty level of less than $2 per day in 2011, a huge number of people, considering the billions of dollars paid to global corporations to free the world of poverty. Although the percentage of officially impoverished has declined due to population growth and standard of living changes, the actual numbers have increased. Over the past three decades, 60 of the world's poorest countries have paid $550 billion in principal and interest on loans of $540 billion, yet they still owe a whopping $523 billion on those same loans. The cost of servicing that debt is more than these countries spend on health or education, and is 20 times the amount they receive annually in foreign aid. In addition, World Bank projects have brought untold suffering to some of the planet's poorest people. In the past 10 years alone, such projects have forced an estimated 3.4 million people out of their homes. The governments in these countries have beaten, tortured, and killed opponents of World Bank projects. My colleagues and I did whatever we thought it would take to expand the corporate, capitalist empire. That was the real goal. The World Bank motto was a subterfuge. We convinced the government leaders that unless they accepted our loans and paid us to train their militaries and build up their infrastructures, their citizens would be ruled by brutal Stalin-style dictators. Corporate capitalism would boost them out of the dark ages of feudalism and into the modern era of U.S.-driven prosperity. It is a system that has mushroomed since Confessions of an Economic Hitman was first published. Today, in addition to the World Bank, it is promoted by the private banks, by the individuals who admit to criminal activities and, instead of prison terms, receive multi-million dollar bonuses. They and their corporate colleagues convince people around the world that success is defined by personal assets rather than by contributions to the greater community, that privatization and deregulation protect the public, that government assistance for the needy is wasteful and counterproductive, that personal debt is better than government investment in social services, and that men and women who live in mansions and travel in private jets and luxury yachts are icons to be emulated. Howard Zinn understood why a majority of us accept these platitudes. Those in the middle class, he said, who have the material trappings of prosperity, are complacent because they possess the things they were taught to covet, and they don't want to lose them. Those who live in poverty are complacent because they have to devote their energies towards simply surviving. All of this is expertly managed by a whole new breed of EHMs. Chapter 43. Who are today's economic hitmen? Back in the 1970s, economically developing countries were looked upon as nests of corruption. People like me plied our trade quietly, but just about everyone assumed that Latin American, African, and Asian government officials thrived on bribes. The image of the Banana Republic politician accepting an envelope stuffed with dollars in exchange for favors granted was ingrained in the press and in Hollywood. The United States, on the other hand, was considered to be, and for the most part was, above such massive corruption. That has totally changed. Drastically. Activities that would have been viewed as immoral, unacceptable, and illegal in the United States in my EHM days are now standard practice. They may be covered in a patina of oblique rhetoric, but beneath that surface, the same old tools, including a combination of threats, bribes, falsified reports, extortion, sex, and sometimes violence, are applied at the highest levels of business and government. EHMs are ubiquitous. They stroll from the corridors of the White House through the U.S. Congress, along Wall Street, and into the boardrooms of every major company. Corruption at the top has become legitimized because corporate EHMs draft the laws and finance the politicians who pass them. The last time I saw Howard Zinn, I asked him where he'd turn to learn more about the modern EHM. Study politicians like Daschle and Dodd, he advised. I didn't get around to following that advice until after Howard's death, when I started writing this book. Then I discovered that, once again, he had known exactly where to look. Tom Daschle and Chris Dodd have a lot in common. Both served as distinguished long-term members of the U.S. Senate, Daschle from 1987 to 2005, Dodd from 1981 to 2011. Both were rising stars in the Democratic Party. Daschle was Senate Majority Leader. Dodd was General Chairman of the Democratic National Committee and Chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, as well as a presidential candidate. Both were powerful men with access to the President of the United States and the leaders of countries and corporations around the planet. Daschle and Dodd portrayed themselves as men of the people rather than Washington insiders. Daschle's early campaigns showed him driving a beat-up Pontiac. Dodd promised he would never succumb to the greedy opportunism of lobbyists. Eventually, however, both Daschle and Dodd betrayed their images and the promises they had made to their constituents. They represent a new, powerful, and very dangerous group of people, the contemporary club of EHMs. After leaving the Senate, Daschle joined a law firm that nets millions of dollars through political lobbying for healthcare and other corporations. His salary plus bonuses was reported to be over $2 million, in addition to income from a private equity firm. Adopting ambiguous sobriquets, such as political advisor, he tried to avoid the classification of lobbyist, although his job was exactly that, to lobby for lucrative deals that benefited his clients. One telling example happened after a garment factory in Bangladesh collapsed in 2013, killing more than 1,100 people. Although there is no indication that Daschle himself was involved, his law firm, DLA Piper, fought the implementation of a Bangladesh plan for legally binding safety reforms aimed at protecting low-income workers. Instead, DLA Piper lobbied for legislation that would drastically limit the liability of wealthy U.S. retailers. Joined by retired Democratic Senator George Mitchell and former Senate aide Charlie Sheeler, DLA Piper sought to protect the avaricious interests of its clients, including one of the retailers identified with the factory collapse, Gap, at the expense of the people and economy of Bangladesh. Like Daschle, Senator Dodd worked hard to project the aura of a politician with deep integrity. He insisted that he would not sell out to corporate America and would never join the club of fellow politicians who had become lobbyists. Yet when he ran for President of the United States, his campaign accepted funding from the financial services industry, the very businesses that were regulated by the Senate Banking Committee that he chaired. This apparent conflict of interest was surpassed by what he did after he retired from the Senate in 2010. Despite his repeated promises never to be a lobbyist, in 2011 he replaced Dan Glickman as chairman and chief lobbyist for the Motion Picture Association of America. Howard had set me on a path. As I followed it, I found that such conversations are by no means limited to Democrats. Among the better-known Republicans who have jumped from the Senate into the lobbyist club are John Ashcroft, Bob Dole, Newt Gingrich, Phil Graham, Chuck Hagel, Trent Lott, Warren Rudman. The list of both Democrats and Republicans seems endless, and there are still more from the U.S. House of Representatives who have transformed themselves into EHMs. Most of these politicians, along with the thousands of other men and women who pass through the revolving door, don't call themselves lobbyists. They work for law firms and go by euphemistic titles such as counselor, consultant, or advisor in government affairs, just as I officially was chief economist for a highly regarded consulting firm. However, their real job, as mine was, is to con governments and the public into submitting to policies that make the rich richer and the poor poorer. They are EHMs, paid to support the corporatocracy, expand the corporate empire, and spread the tentacles of the death economy across the planet. They hide in the shadows, yet their influence is immeasurable. It is significant that the American League of Lobbyists, a professional association for the industry, changed its name to the Association of Government Relations Professionals in 2013. Although the number of registered lobbyists dropped to its lowest level in more than a decade during that same year, its ranks still numbered 12,281, a whopping 23 lobbyists for every member of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, many times the number of EHMs during my time. Yet even this shocking number is highly understated. Research by American University professor James Thurber, an expert in lobbying for more than three decades, suggests that the true number of working lobbyists is closer to 100,000. Official figures indicate that annual spending to support lobbyist campaigns was more than $3 billion in 2013, but Thurber estimates that it was closer to $9 billion. The lack of transparency, the secrecy surrounding the influence peddling of lobbyists, makes it impossible to accurately measure the full impact of such activities. However, each of the biggest companies doing business in the United States today has upward of 100 lobbyists. These corporations and their associations spend more than $30 for every dollar invested by all the labor unions and public interest groups that represent we the people in activities that promote workers' rights, the environment, healthcare, education, and other social services. Officials charged with enforcing the laws are afraid to challenge the lobbyists and the corporations they represent. This passage from Common Dreams addresses the arms industry, but the statement is representative of global corporations in general. Out of the top 10 international arms producers, 8 are American. The arms industry spends millions lobbying Congress and state legislatures, and it defends its turf with an efficiency and vigor that its products don't always emulate on the battlefield. The F-35 fighter bomber, for example, the most expensive weapons system in U.S. history, will cost $1.5 trillion and doesn't work. It's over budget, dangerous to fly, and riddled with defects. And yet few lawmakers dare challenge the powerful corporations who have shoved this lemon down our throats. One of these arms producers, Boeing, made big news in the state where I live. Washington's largest employer, with more than 80,000 employees, it ranks one of the three largest defense contractors in the world. The other two, Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman, are likewise based in the United States. Boeing lobbyists worked day and night to convince Washington state officials to give the company huge tax breaks, and the company threatened to move production facilities for the 777X plane to another state if the politicians did not deliver. I heard stories about legal bribes that were all too familiar. Consultant retainers and jobs offered to relatives and friends of government officials. Entrapment into compromising situations involving sex or drugs. Although such allegations were never proven, the mere existence of the stories had an impact. People with marital problems or who had tried an illicit drug or felt they could be framed bowed to the pressures of anyone they feared might expose them. In the end, the Washington state legislature passed a law that activated the largest corporate tax break in any state's history, with an estimated lifetime value to Boeing of $8.7 billion. That law ensured the aerospace giant's position as the United States' number one corporate recipient of state and local subsidies. It was a spectacular victory for Boeing's EHMs, and a huge loss for Washington state taxpayers such as me, and for democracy in general. The way Boeing manipulated Washington state officials illustrates the methods used by a special class of EHMs known as site location consultants. Although they technically could be classified as lobbyists, they are highly specialized. For years, they have been involved in the economically developing countries. However, today, as the Boeing case shows, they are a major factor in the United States. Business schools and planners may claim that corporate decisions about locating their job-creating facilities are based on rational analyses of such objective factors as proximity to suppliers and customers, labor markets, existing infrastructure conditions of transportation networks, and the price of energy. But the greatest determinant in many cases has become the deal made with local governments. Site location consultants play to fears that communities will be rejected unless they offer the most lenient environmental and social regulations, the lowest tax rates, and other incentives. Although public officials are usually eager to arrange such deals, they overlook the long-term consequences. Deteriorating schools, roads, recreational facilities, and natural resources, even though, ironically, such community assets benefit the entire community, including the corporation's own employees. One further aspect of site location consultants is that they often are paid by the community and, in the end, may also receive a commission as high as 30% on the subsidies they manage to negotiate, their payment from the corporation. The Boeing deal was reminiscent of things I'd done in Argentina, Colombia, Ecuador, Egypt, Indonesia, and Panama. The main difference is that, instead of World Bank loans, modern EHMs in the United States use tax policy and subsidies. These stratagems are even more effective than loans. Corporations avoid the need to register the money, or to sign contracts that force them to set up systems to ensure that the debtor actually pays. In this U.S. version, no one has to put up the funds. Instead, the money is simply removed from the tax base and handed to the corporation. In essence, the money is stolen from the U.S. taxpayer. Funds that have been earmarked for health care, education, and other social services are diverted to the coffers of greedy corporations, gifts from the lobbyist EHMs and corrupt politicians. My research took me to Good Jobs First, a national policy center that reviews the grants, loans, and other subsidies distributed by the federal government since 2000. According to its reports, over the course of the past 15 years, the federal government has distributed $68 billion in grants and special tax credits to businesses. Two-thirds of that money was transferred to large corporations. Good Jobs First identified the major companies whose lobbyists have been most successful at obtaining subsidies. These include Dow Chemical, Ford Motor Company, General Electric, General Motors, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Lockheed Martin, United Technologies, and almost half of the 100 most profitable federal contractors. All told, a shocking 298 corporations each received subsidies of $60 million or more. These companies reap benefits from ports, airports, highways, utilities, schools, fire departments, and other services, and make billions of dollars in profits, yet they do not pay their fair share towards supporting the institutions that serve them and their employees. I was not surprised to learn that the fossil fuel industry is highly subsidized. However, the magnitude of such subsidies is far greater than I'd anticipated. A recent investigation by The Guardian reveals that coal, oil, and gas industries benefited from subsidies of $550 billion, four times the amount given to renewable energy. Typical were three projects that, due to the efforts of EHMs, had been granted subsidies by politicians whose campaigns received large contributions from the fossil fuels industry. A proposed Shell petrochemical refinery in Pennsylvania will receive $1.6 billion, £1 billion, in state subsidy, according to a deal struck in 2012, when the company made an annual profit of $26.8 billion. ExxonMobil's upgrades to its Baton Rouge refinery in Louisiana are benefiting from $119 million of state subsidy, with the support starting in 2011, when the company made a $41 billion profit. A jobs subsidy scheme worth $78 million to Marathon Petroleum in Ohio began in 2011, when the company made $2.4 billion in profit. The EHMs of agribusiness are perhaps the most famous, or infamous, of all. Just one example was the passage of H.R. 1599 by the U.S. House of Representatives in July 2015. Known officially as the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act of 2015, but called the Deny Americans the Right to Know, DARK, Act by its opponents, the law is intended to block states from requiring the labeling of products containing genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. The Grocery Manufacturers Association and Monsanto EHMs poured millions of dollars into making this bill happen. According to The Guardian, passage of this bill is an attempt by Monsanto and its agribusiness cronies to crush the democratic decision-making of tens of millions of Americans. Corporate influence has won and the voice of the people has been ignored, stated Andrew Kimbrell, executive director of Center for Food Safety. Environmental Working Group, EWG, was also opposed to the bill and cited widespread public support for labeling GMOs. It's outrageous that some House lawmakers voted to ignore the wishes of 9 out of 10 Americans, said Scott Faber, senior vice president of government affairs for EWG. The steal from the poor, give to the rich programs are by no means restricted to arms, energy, and agriculture businesses. They are pervasive across the economic spectrum. One example is Walmart. A Schwar friend who recently visited the United States asked to see this most famous store, Walmart. I told him that I don't shop there, but I'd be happy to take him on a tour. Before we went, I shared with him information published by Americans for Tax Fairness. It shocked us both. That report described the ways in which Walmart has siphoned billions of dollars from U.S. taxpayers. Among their various tools is a vast network of overseas tax havens, with assets valued at more than $76 billion. According to the report, Walmart has established at least 78 subsidiaries in 15 offshore tax havens, none of them publicly reported before. The analysis, titled The Walmart Web, How the World's Biggest Corporations Use Tax Havens to Dodge Taxes, shows that Walmart has no fewer than 22 shell companies in Luxembourg, 20 established since 2009 and 5 in 2015 alone. According to the study, Walmart has transferred ownership of more than $45 billion in assets to those subsidiaries since 2011, but reported paying less than 1% in tax to Luxembourg on $1.3 billion in profits from 2010 through 2013. As we strolled down the seemingly endless aisles of merchandise, my Schwar friend pointed out that no one was talking to anyone else. In my country, he said, markets are places where we learn what's going on with our friends and neighbors, and the world. Here, people ignore each other. They just shop. He was also amazed at the number of different items of essentially the same product. How do you decide, he asked, whether to buy soap in the blue box, the red box, or the yellow box? One of the most disturbing reports estimated that Walmart workers are subsidized by U.S. taxpayers to the tune of more than $6 billion a year in public nutrition, health care, and housing assistance programs. The owners of this mega cash cow, the members of the Walton family, are listed among the wealthiest billionaires on the planet. They, like so many of their cohorts, may criticize social programs for everyone else, but they are beneficiaries of the biggest socialized programs in history. Vulture funds are one more example of how this EHM cancer has metastasized. After a country has defaulted and fallen into a state of economic chaos, these funds purchase that country's debt for a few cents on the dollar. Then, when the country's economy begins to recover, the funds demand payment of the debt, plus interest, often tacking on additional fees. Many take this a step further by suing businesses that try to work with the target country, thus compounding the damage by scaring off potential investors. The 26 largest vultures have collected $1 billion from the world's poorest countries, and still have another $1.3 billion earmarked for collection. That $1 billion is more than twice the budget of the International Committee of the Red Cross for all of Africa in 2011. It could finance the entire UN appeal for the famine in Somalia. Vulture funds have gone after Argentina, Brazil, Congo-Brazzaville, Ecuador, Greece, Iceland, and Ireland, and they have their sights set on just about every other country with debt and economic problems, including Italy and other European countries. Although there are many examples, Peru's is a typical case. Peru was caught in a downward spiral of economic and social turmoil in 1983. This was exacerbated by terrorist activities and unmanageable external loans. After long negotiations, its debts were restructured in 1996. Elliott Associates, a hedge fund run by Paul Singer, a major supporter of political campaigns, purchased around $20 million of the defaulted Peruvian loans for about $11 million, and then sued the country and its central bank for the original amount, plus interest, in a New York court. Elliott won a $58 million settlement and cleared $47 million in profit, a more than 400% rate of return on its investment. This windfall profit came at a huge cost to environmental and social programs in Peru. The last global recession and the ensuing crises across much of the world resulted in increased exploitation by vulture funds. In addition to countries such as Peru, or European countries with developed economies, more than a third of the 39 countries that qualify for debt relief under the World Bank's heavily indebted poor countries programs, mostly located in Africa, have been targeted. In Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I portrayed the World Bank and its affiliates as organizations that use debt to enslave nations. That certainly was and is correct. Since then, however, the vulture funds have elevated debt as slavery to new levels. Like so many activities promoted by EHMs, vulture funds not only devastate their target countries, but also destabilize the global economy. According to Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel laureate in economics and former senior vice president and chief economist at the World Bank, in Argentina, the authorities' battles with a small number of investors, so-called vulture funds, jeopardized an entire debt restructuring agreed to voluntarily by an overwhelming majority of the country's creditors. In Greece, the country is forced into austerity policies that have contributed mightily to a 25% decline in GDP and have left its population worse off. In Ukraine, the potential political ramifications of sovereign debt distress are enormous. As I look back over the decades and compare what was happening in the 1970s with what is happening today among EHMs and their corporatocracy bosses, perhaps the most frightening observation is that the nefarious activities today are so much more pervasive than they were then, and that they are widely accepted by the executives who manage our most powerful corporations, by educators who set the standards in our business schools, and by the general public. A handful of robber barons and their henchmen, the modern EHMs, have conspired to convince the rest of us that they have the right to do anything they deem necessary to support the debt and fear dogma. Citing U.S. Supreme Court decisions and euphemisms about the virtues of their very narrow version of capitalism, they've persuaded us to give them license to make themselves fabulously wealthy. And they've done this with our tacit approval, at our expense. 1% of Americans received 95% of all the wealth created since the Depression was officially pronounced as ended in 2009, while 90% of us became poorer. For every $1 billion of wealth created, the average U.S. citizen gets $1. Globally, 85 individuals own more resources than half of the world's population. The examples provided here are only a few drops in the bucket of impact that today's corporate EHMs have on U.S. and global economics, politics, environmental issues, and society. They illustrate the extent to which EHMs have transformed themselves and have taken over the world since my days in those ranks. Something equally appalling has happened among the jackals. Chapter 44. Who are today's jackals? I was walking along a street in the village where my grandparents live in Pakistan, said Jafar, a student I met in Istanbul, where I was speaking at a business conference. Suddenly, the building next to me exploded, hit by a missile from a drone. People ran out, screaming. A woman carrying her baby was on fire. I rushed to her, took her baby, and told her to roll on the ground. His eyes filled with tears. She survived, but many people died. Many. That drone was controlled by a new breed of jackal. As I listen to people like Jafar, and as I read reports about drone strikes, I am filled with feelings that I find hard to describe. I grew up on stories of World War II heroism, images of U.S. GIs rescuing children from flaming buildings, storming the beaches of Normandy, and liberating Nazi concentration camps. I saw the 1950s, I led three lives type of FBI agent who infiltrated communist cells as incredibly courageous. So too did I view the CIA agents who penetrated secret Soviet networks and the jackals who flew into Seychelles. Even those who did things I opposed, such as planting bombs on the plains of Roldos and Torrijos, took huge personal risks. But drone operators, they don't risk their lives. They don't hear the screams of the wounded and dying, or witness the suffering of innocent victims. They sit at computer monitors. They aren't brave. There is nothing heroic about their jobs. Nor is there anything heroic about a nation that inflicts such suffering on other people. Certainly, I feel ashamed by what we are doing in the world today. But perhaps more than anything, I feel a profound confusion, a sense of utter bewilderment. I keep asking myself those questions that had come to me in the Hanoi prison. What are our leaders thinking? Can't they see that such ruthless disregard for life destroys the reputation of a nation that gained the world's respect during World War II? Although there are frequent news stories about the drone assassinations of the leaders of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, it is impossible to obtain statistics about all the mistakes that are made, what the Pentagon refers to as collateral damage. Innocent civilians killed. The best anyone can do is estimate, and these estimates are shocking. At least 6,000 people's lives have been unjustly taken by United States drone attacks in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, the Philippines, Libya, and Syria, says a June 2015 letter released by dozens of U.S. military veterans. The letter goes on to urge drone operators to refuse to fly missions or to support such activities in any way. These veterans understand that indiscriminate drone strikes on civilians are defined by most of the world as acts of terror. Many veterans have seen firsthand that the actions of drone operators and many other modern jackals fill the pockets of corporate magnates who profit from war, destruction, reconstruction, and the oil fields and other resources that are at the heart of so many conflicts. At the same time, these actions undermine U.S. credibility, are contrary to the interests of American citizens, and foster the continuation of a fear-based economy. President Obama's former top military intelligence official, Retired U.S. Lieutenant General Michael Flynn described the use of drones as a failed strategy that only encourages violence and terrorism. When you drop a bomb from a drone, you are going to cause more damage than you are going to cause good, he said. And Flynn should know. He headed up the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency until the summer of 2014. Jackals today wear many disguises and perform tasks that those in my time would have considered inappropriate, cowardly, or even counterproductive. Documents recently released by WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden reveal an alarming increase in the use of CIA torture and extraordinary rendition sites, paramilitary forces hired by governments and global corporations, and CIA Special Forces high-value target assassination programs. Unlike the loner secret agents who depend on their wits and physical prowess, an entirely new generation of pack jackals is supported by airstrikes, satellites, and other modern technologies. Although Americans are kept in the dark about the operations of the Pentagon's specially trained military teams, primarily Navy SEAL and Army Delta Force personnel, they are no secret to the communities where they strike. The New York Times lamented the veil of secrecy that surrounds such units in an article published in June 2015, SEAL Team 6, A Secret History of Quiet Killings and Blurred Lines. Around the world, they have run spying stations disguised as commercial boats, posed as civilian employees of front companies, and operated undercover at embassies as male-female pairs, tracking those the United States wants to kill or capture. Those operations are part of the hidden history of the Navy's SEAL Team 6, one of the nation's most mythologized, most secretive, and least scrutinized military organizations. Once a small group reserved for specialized but rare missions, the unit best known for killing Osama bin Laden has been transformed by more than a decade of combat into a global manhunting machine. The article went on to decry the fact that so much of current U.S. policy is conducted in secret. One of the conclusions reached by the Times investigative team, like the CIA's campaign of drone strikes, special operations missions offer policymakers an alternative to costly wars of occupation. But the bulwark of secrecy around Team 6 makes it impossible to fully assess its record and the consequences of its actions, including civilian casualties or the deep resentment inside the countries where its members operate. Concern for that resentment is not limited to veterans groups and the media. It is also expressed by students in U.S. colleges where I speak. They refer to men and women their age who travel from Australia, the U.S., and Europe to the Middle East to join ISIS and other militant Islamist organizations. They speculate that resentment and desperation drive these young people to take such actions. They worry that U.S. policies encourage terrorism. Students often mention that most of the countries where potential terrorists are recruited have long histories of advocating violence as the solution to problems, and that even the language used by U.S. policymakers for programs that would seem to have nothing to do with violence are couched in terms like fighting poverty, conquering hunger, and the war on drugs. They point out that movies and TV shows eulogize guns and the tough guy approach to dealing with difficult situations. The jackals in my day usually were assigned to foreign lands, with the exception of those involved in counterinsurgency and infiltrating communist cells inside the United States. That, too, has changed. In the aftermath of 9/11, fear drove Americans to agree to sacrifice privacy and freedom and give the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, and other agencies unprecedented powers. Tools perfected overseas, including drones and surveillance aircraft, are now used to spy on us in the United States. Documents released by U.S. federal authorities in response to a Freedom of Information lawsuit reveal that at least 63 drone sites, located in 20 states, were active in the United States as of 2012. Many were operated by soldiers and were deployed from stateside military installations. Others were manned by law enforcement agencies and the U.S. Border Patrol. Some, if not all, are designed to assassinate people. In June 2015, the Associated Press reported that the FBI has a small air force with scores of low-flying planes across the U.S. carrying video and, at times, cell phone surveillance technology, all hidden behind fictitious companies that are fronts for the government. The article went on to say that these flights are usually conducted without a judge's approval, and that, in a recent 30-day period, the agency flew above